so busy over the past few months that he'd only had occasional moments to devote to that project.
There are a lot of nooks and crannies in that kind of matrix sheet, so I can't say for certain. But right now, I can't find any building project that could be absorbing anywhere near the amount of dunium that's been disappearing from the markets.
And the finances themselves?
Again, nothing obvious. If something's going on, it's being very well hidden.
Interesting, Thrawn murmured.
I trust you will continue your investigation.
He gestured toward the datapad.
In the meantime, we have these Vultra droids to consider. You say they are being purchased?
Yes, Eli said. And the buy-up's not just local, either. You can't get numbers rising this fast unless all the surrounding sectors are being drained, too.
That was my assumption as well,
Thrawn agreed.
And with no other obvious value to the droids, the likely conclusion is that the buyer intends to use them.
Not much a Vultra droid can be used for except to shoot at other people,
Eli pointed out.
And their tech has to be at least a couple of decades old. I was under the impression that we'd pretty much learned how to deal with them.
It is possible we have forgotten,
Thrawn pointed out.
As weaponry advances, the techniques used against obsolete ordnance may be neglected or lost.
Possibly, Eli said. Takes a pretty confident person to think he can beat modern turbo lasers with blaster cannons, though.
Thrawn shrugged.
I could.
Right, but you're on our side, Eli said dryly. Who else could?
Thrawn raised his eyebrows in silent question. Eli frowned.
Let me guess. Night Swan?
The Rodian who sold me the Vultra droid part had an order for more such parts under the name Night Swan,
Thrawn confirmed.
The merchant let you see his order requests?
He was unaware that I did so.
Ah,
Eli said, peering closely at him. Ever since Uba and the lost Tabana, Thrawn had a subtle but strong focus. Eli refused to call it an obsession, even in the privacy of his own mind, toward Night Swan. Over the past year, Thrawn had been summoned back to Coruscant 4 times to consult with the Emperor. And during each of those visits, he'd made time to visit Colonel Yularen for a private and unofficial update on Night Swan's activities.
I don't suppose there could be a second Night Swan out there.
That is always possible, Thrawn said. But consider, we know our Night Swan specializes in clever strategies. We know he has seen firsthand the effectiveness of old technology and weapons that no one expects to face. And along with the name, the request specified that payment would be in Iridium.
So you're also tagging him for the operation we just took down?
Eli shook his head.
I don't know. Night Swan is smart. These guys are idiots.
Indeed, they are,
Thrawn agreed.
Which is why I asked one of them about the mollusk meat as they were being locked away. He admitted that the man who set up the scheme specifically told them to disperse the meat over their entire path. They told him that was too much trouble.
Interesting, Eli said. Still doesn't qualify as proof.
True, but it bears further examination,
Thrawn said.
I will inform the commander of my thoughts and speculations. Meanwhile, perhaps you could track the smuggled metals and look for a connection to Vultra droid purchases.
I'll do what I can, Eli said. But lines like that are pretty easy to cover up.
I trust your abilities,
Thrawn said.
We must also watch for reports of trouble on the planet Umbara.
Why Umbara?
The smugglers remember that the man who instructed them mentioned that world.
Sounds like misdirection,
Eli warned.
Umbara was one of the major separatist planets. The locals fought pretty hard and got stomped pretty solidly. Hard to believe they want to go through that again.
Agreed,
Thrawn said.
But we will watch for reports from there just the same. His expression hardened. Night Swan escaped the Empire once. I'm sure the Empire would appreciate it if we remedied that failure.
Art. For some, it was a measure of culture. For others, it was a measure of wealth. For most, it was a matter of simple enjoyment. For Thrawn, it was an invaluable tool. The Thunder Wasp's computer library had only a limited catalog of art reproductions, and only 3 pieces of those were from Umbara. Fortunately, Thrawn had spent the past 3 years building up an extensive collection of data cards that rivaled the best art archives in the Empire. He sat in his cabin surrounded by holograms of sculptures, flats, mobiles, kinetics, interactives, and other art forms that Umbarans had developed and explored over the centuries. Of particular interest were the subtle changes that had taken place between works created before and after the Clone Wars. The other Chiss didn't understand. They never had. He'd been asked innumerable times how he was able to build such detailed tactical knowledge from such obscure and insignificant ingredients. The question carried its own answer. To Thrawn, nothing in a species' art was obscure or insignificant. All the threads tied together. All the brushstrokes spoke to him. All the light curves told the story of their creator. Artists were individuals, but they were also products of their culture and history and philosophy. The weave of artist and culture was evident to the discerning eye. The fundamental pattern of a species could be sketched, then drawn, then fully fleshed out. Most important of all, the relationships among art, culture, and military doctrine could be deduced. And what could be deduced could be countered. Distantly, Thrawn became aware that a new image had entered the pattern of Umbaran art flowing around him. Reluctantly, he withdrew his mind from contemplation and reflection and narrowed his focus. Ensign Vanto had entered his cabin.
"Ensign," Thrawn said, "you disturb my solitude."
"You worried us,"
Vanto countered.
His expression is concerned.
"Commander Chino has been trying to reach you by intercom for the past 10 minutes. We've entered the Umbara system, and he wants you on the bridge."
"My apologies," Thrawn said. "I was more focused than I realized."
"Sure,"
Vanto said.
He looks around at the artwork.
"The commander thought you might have become ill. What's all this?"
"Art of the Umbaran people,"
Thrawn said.
"Has the rest of the task force arrived?" "Our Star Destroyer has,"
Vanto said.
"He continues to study the artwork with interest."
"The ISD foremost. Admiral Carlu Gendlin commanding. He has 2 of his 4 corvettes with him, but he sent the other 2 and his light cruiser off to investigate a problem that just cropped up in another system."
"Is Admiral Gendling planning to wait for the other ships?"
"He seems confident that we can handle the matter without their help,"
Vanto said.
"I'm assuming that once we reach orbit, he'll order the dissidents to proceed to the nearest garrison or police station and surrender themselves and their weapons. Commander Chino wants you on the bridge just in case they don't."
"Understood," Thrawn said. "Please convey my apologies to the commander and tell him I shall join him momentarily."
He reached the bridge to find the combat crew assembled and at their proper stations. All indicators showed the Thunder Wasp at full battle readiness.
"Reporting for duty, Commander," he said. "My apologies for the delay."
"No problem,"
Chino said. He peers closely at Thrawn's face.
"Are you all right? I thought you might have been taken ill."
"I'm well,"
Thrawn assured him.
I understand Admiral Gendling is preparing to deliver an ultimatum.
Yes,
Chino said.
His expression indicates apprehension.
I advised him to wait for the rest of the task force, but Gendling is an impatient sort.
He steps closer to Thrawn and lowers the volume of his voice.
He also has a somewhat overinflated view of himself and his capabilities,
he added.
Though, that's just my opinion.
Not simply your opinion, sir, Thrawn said. The overall pattern of his career validates your assessment.
Really?
Chino said.
He is surprised.
You've studied his career?
I have given it a cursory examination.
Really? Have you made the same cursory examination of my career?
You have not been offered the same opportunities as Admiral Gendling, Thrawn said. Without such, there is little chance for you to prove your abilities.
Even if I could,
Chino said.
His expression is wry and understanding.
No, don't try to spare my feelings. You're a brilliant officer. I'm an adequate one. You'll rise through the ranks. I'll end my career quietly.
He turned back to the forward viewport.
But maybe we'll be lucky. Maybe we'll have to fight a battle, and you'll win it for me. At least the Thunder Wasp will finally get some recognition.
He nodded aft.
The starboard turbolaser targeting system has been giving us some problems. Go see if Ensign Vanto needs assistance checking the diagnostics, if you would.
Yes, sir.
Vanto was standing by the weapons diagnostic station when Thrawn arrived.
Ensign, Thrawn greeted him. Report on the starboard targeting system.
They just ran a diagnostic, Vanto said.
No obvious problem, but the thing's been twitchy, so we're running it again.
Did I hear Commander Chino hoping the Umbarans take a shot at us?
You did, Thrawn confirmed. But his hope will likely remain unfulfilled. The Umbarans will not attack.
Really, sir? Vanto said, his tone one of surprise.
Because they attacked just fine during the Clone Wars. But only when they perceive themselves as having an advantage in numbers or position or command capability, Thrawn said. Those factors do not exist here. Furthermore, their homeworld stands to absorb severe damage from orbital bombardment if they initiate combat.
Ah, Vanto said.
Too bad for Commander Chino, I guess.
On the main comm display, Admiral Gendling's face appeared.
People of Umbara, he said.
His voice is strong and proud, carrying both challenge and contempt.
Or perhaps I should say insurgents of Umbara. This is Admiral Carlu Gendling of the Imperial Star Destroyer Foremost. You have engaged in sedition and gathered weapons in defiance of Imperial law. In the name of the Emperor, I order you to turn in yourselves and your weapons to the nearest military garrison or police station. Your leaders will be charged according to the severity of their crimes. Those who simply followed out of ignorance or family ties will be permitted to return to their homes and lives without punishment. If you do not comply, your world will face the full destructive force that an Imperial Star Destroyer can bring to bear. I give you 1 hour.
And that's that, Vanto said.
There is a level of regret in his voice. As Commander Chino wishes to test himself in full combat, so too does Vanto.
He'll probably end up sending in a few stormtrooper squads to keep order and make sure the troublemakers remember what's sitting over their heads. But for us...
Incoming!
Senior Lieutenant Hammerly called from the sensor station.
Her voice held surprise and tension.
Numerous craft incoming from behind the outer moon. 200, 300, 400, 400 craft incoming on our starboard aft quarter, moving on attack vectors. Identification. Vulture droids.
Chapter 13. No battle plan can anticipate all contingencies. There are always unexpected factors, including those stemming from the opponent's initiative. A battle thus becomes a balance between plan and improvisation, between intellect and reflex, between error and correction. It is a narrow line, but it is a line one's opponent must also walk. For all the balance of experience and cleverness, it is often the warrior who acts quickest who will prevail.
All ships disperse!
Admiral Gendling's voice boomed across the bridge.
180-degree turn! Prepare for combat!
Eli snarled under his breath. What did the overblown excuse for an admiral think they'd been doing? But one of the Thunder Wasp's officers, at least, didn't seem to hear any implied slight in the order. Commander Chino was standing stiff and tall on the command walkway, his head held high, his shoulders back. This was his chance, maybe his last chance, to shine in combat.
"Turbolasers, stand ready!"
he called.
"Helm, bring us aft and above the foremost. Gunners! Your job is to intercept and destroy enemy fighters targeting the foremost's dorsal surfaces."
A chorus of acknowledgments came from the crew pits.
"Looks like he got his wish after all, sir,"
Eli murmured to Thrawn.
"No,"
Thrawn said.
"Excuse me?" "He wished to meet the Umbarans in combat, but this attack is not theirs."
"It's coming from an Umbaran moon,"
Eli pointed out, trying to filter the sarcasm out of his voice. Thrawn's unshakable confidence still sometimes got to him.
"The whole system is full of Umbarans. The Umbaran leaders aren't screaming to Gendling that it's not them, and please don't shoot."
"Because they do not yet see themselves in a position of weakness," Thrawn said. "They are watching the attack to see if we are weakened sufficiently for them to engage us."
Eli shook his head.
"How do you know all this?"
"All weapons, fire!"
Chino called. The Thunder Wasp's bridge lit up with flickers of green light as turbolaser bolts shot outward toward the incoming fighters. A few of the vulture droids were hit, shattering instantly into brilliant explosions of smoke and debris. But most of them avoided the cruiser's attack with ease.
"Fire again!"
Chino bit out.
"And this time, hit them!"
"They're too small, sir," Weapons Officer Osgood called back. "We're going to have to wait until they're closer." Before Chino could answer, the vulture droids opened up with their own volley of return fire.
"Deflectors!"
Chino snapped. His voice, Eli noted, was starting to sound strained. Small wonder. Theoretically, vulture droids should be no match for Imperial ships of the line, but there were a hell of a lot of them. The cruiser's gunners tried their best, but they could do little against the incoming swarm. The smaller craft were too fast, too distant, and too nimble. The Thunder Wasp kept firing, but only a few of the bolts found their targets. Meanwhile, the vulture droid's own return fire was tearing into the Thunder Wasp's hull, penetrating gaps in overloaded shields to destroy sensors, weapons emplacements, and a small but rapidly growing number of outer hull plates. Eli looked at the tactical display. So far, the foremost seemed to be holding its own, but the two Raider-class corvettes were being pummeled even harder than the Thunder Wasp. And still, Commander Chino stood on the command walkway, unmoving, silent, in over his head. Helpless. Eli stole a look at Thrawn. The Chiss was also standing motionless, his face as impassive as Chino's. But there was something about him that sent a shiver up Eli's back. Thrawn saw something. Somewhere in all that chaos and destruction, he saw something.
Abruptly, he seemed to come to a decision.
"Who here has had combat experience with vulture droids?" he called.
"I have, sir,"
Hammerly called back, raising her hand.
"Turbo laser station one, Lieutenant," Thrawn ordered.
"Commander?"
Hammerly asked, looking at Chino for confirmation.
"Go,"
Chino ordered her, his voice grim.
"Secondary sensor officer?"
"I will take the chief sensor officer's position," Thrawn interrupted. "Ensign Vanto, with me."
A few seconds later, Thrawn was seated at Hammerly's console. Eli stood behind him, trying very hard not to look as nervous as he felt. Bad enough that they were being taken apart by an attacking force they couldn't stop. But by throwing orders around without Chino's approval, Thrawn had effectively usurped command. Eli's mind flashed back to Captain Rossi and Admiral Wiskovis, and their reactions to Thrawn's casual disregard for chain of command protocol.
"Now what?"
he asked in a low voice.
"Did you already know Hammerly had been in combat?"
"I needed a reason to take her station," Thrawn replied quietly. "I have studied vulture droids, Ensign. They do not normally fight this effectively."
Eli looked at the display. The fighters had closed with the four Imperial ships and were swarming around them, pouring in continual fire while still largely managing to dodge the defenders' counterattack.
"Well, they weren't designed to be very smart on their own," he pointed out. "A few simple pre-programmed maneuvers and combat patterns. Throw in huge numbers to overwhelm their targets."
"There," Thrawn jabbed a finger.
"That group of four. Did you see it?"
Eli frowned.
"No." "Their drive emission suddenly increased, allowing them to speed up," Thrawn said. "But there was no reason for extra speed. They were already evading our attack quite effectively."
"Okay,"
Eli said, frowning harder. The group Thrawn had tagged were weaving through the turbo laser blasts and coming around for another volley.
He stiffened. "There it was. I saw it."
"Good,"
Thrawn said.
"Note how their combat style also changes. Instead of firing with deliberation at vulnerable spots, they fire indiscriminately, whether the target point is worth shooting at or not."
"Got it,"
Eli said. The shifts in combat style were subtle, but now that he knew what to look for, they were quite visible.
"So what does it mean?"
"You said yourself that these droids are not clever," Thrawn said. "Their creators assumed a given fighter would not survive long, and so programmed them to be swarming weapons."
"So burning through their resources as fast as possible, without any long-term considerations?" Eli asked, frowning.
"You sure?"
"Look at the curve of the combat pods," Thrawn said. "The shape of the stripes, the position of the blaster barrels. Weapons such as this not only are functional, but also incorporate the artistry of their creators. The beings who created and built these fighters believe in short, quick answers to questions and problems."
"I'll take your word for it,"
Eli said. The explanation sounded ridiculous, but he'd seen Thrawn pull equally obscure facts out of equally imperceptible visuals.
"Where does that leave us?"
"They are designed to swarm," Thrawn said. "But they only briefly show that tactic. That leads to the conclusion," he paused expectantly,
"that the rest of the time they're under direct command from somewhere,"
Eli said, as it suddenly clicked.
"Somewhere on the outer moon?"
"They were launched from there," Thrawn agreed. "But they are not being controlled from there. The changes occur when the fighters fly through the transmission shadow of one of our ships.
So if we can find and analyze all the shadows, we can backtrack to the transmitter,"
Eli said with a sudden surge of hope.
"And you came here because you needed the sensor station to power through that kind of calculation?"
"Precisely," Thrawn said.
Eli felt his lip twitch as the final element fell into place. By masking his insight and revelation this way, Thrawn was hoping to pass on more of the credit to the rest of the Thunder Wasp's crew, and by logical extension, to Commander Chino.
one last chance for him to shine in combat.
What do you want me to do?
I will run the calculations and coordinate the locations and vectors, Thrawn said. You will watch for other shadows and mark them.
Right.
Eli glanced at the tactical, wincing at all the spots of red that marked major damage to the Imperial ships.
Work fast.
The next 2 minutes dragged by. Eli looked back and forth across the battle, catching three more of the subtle changes that marked a fighter briefly running on its own programming. He had no idea how many Thrawn spotted in that same time period, but the Chiss turned abruptly to his board no fewer than 10 times.
Corvette down!
Eli looked at the tactical, his stomach knotting. Where one of the Raider Corvettes had been, there was now a roiling cloud of shattered metal and fire-tinged debris.
Sir,
he murmured urgently. Done. Thrawn touched a final key, and abruptly, bright yellow crosshairs appeared on the planetary display.
Commander Chino, Thrawn called up toward the command walkway. I believe we have isolated the ground-based transmitter that is coordinating the attack. I recommend that you pass this information to Admiral Gendling and request he target and destroy it.
What are you talking about?
Chino asked, frowning down at him.
What transmitter?
The one feeding tactical data to the vulture droids, Thrawn said. The foremost turbolasers are the only ones that can reach effectively to the surface.
I see,
Chino said. He didn't, Eli suspected, but he knew better than to ignore his first officer's advice.
Come, contact the foremost. Inform the Admiral that I need to speak with him immediately.
Eli huffed out a long sigh. And with that, it was over. Thrawn had come through again, and it was over. Only this time, it wasn't.
Ridiculous, Admiral Gendling scoffed. Even if these fighters are being controlled and haven't simply been reprogrammed, there's no possible way for you to have located the transmitter.
Sir, as I explained...
And I'm not about to go shooting at random into a civilian city on the strength of some mid-level officer's wild guesswork. Let's talk, Commander. More fighting.
Eli winced. In general, not shooting into a civilian population was a perfectly sensible approach to combat. More sensible, in fact, than he would have expected from a lot of Imperial officers. But in this case, the proposed attack was hardly random, and failing to act was likely to be very costly.
Now what? He asked Thrawn.
For a moment, Thrawn stared at the tactical in silence. Then, reaching to the board again, he keyed in a new order. And on both the sensor and tactical displays, a set of moving gray wedges appeared.
Signal all ships, he ordered the comm officer. The gray wedges mark the transmission shadows where the vulture droids rely on their own programming. Within those shadows, they will be most vulnerable, and therefore most easily destroyed. He raised his voice.
Senior Lieutenant Hammerly.
On it, sir,
she called back. On the tactical, four droids flying through the Thunder Wasp's shadow disintegrated in four bursts of turbolaser fire.
That what you had in mind, sir?
It is indeed. Thrawn confirmed. Well done.
All ships acknowledge our transmission, the comm officer added. Gunners are switching tactics.
And with that, the tide finally began to turn.
But it was bloody. In the end, Gendling's remaining corvette was severely damaged, nearly half its crew dead or wounded. The Thunder Wasp and Foremost were in better shape, but both ships would need time in a shipyard before they would be combat-ready again. The vulture droids were all destroyed. The Umbarans had surrendered unconditionally. The foremost stormtrooper squads were on the surface and supervising the surrender of the insurgents. And Admiral Gendling was furious.
You're lucky I don't bring you up on charges right here and now, Commander, the Admiral said.
His expression holds embarrassment and guilt. His tone holds harshness and anger.
You do not usurp an admiral's authority in command that way. I speak for my crew and to my crew.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Admiral,
Commander Chino said.
His tone holds tension, but also resolve.
I was simply trying to recapture the initiative in the most efficient way possible and save the battle, and with it, a few lives.
Are you mocking me, Commander?
Admiral Gendling demanded.
Because if you are, as the Emperor as my witness, I'll take you down so hard and so fast, they'll have to scrape up what's left of your career with a flat cake turner. Whose bright idea was it, anyway? I know you didn't come up with any of that yourself.
Commander Chino's expression remains resolved.
I ordered the information passed to the foremost and the remaining corvette.
There is a small emphasis on the word remaining.
As for the discovery of the enemy's weakness, that was a joint effort of my bridge crew.
With slow deliberation, Admiral Gendling turned his eyes to Thrawn.
His arm and torso muscles are rigid.
Your first officer has built himself quite a reputation,
he said to Chino.
Maybe I should ask him who came up with the transmitter idea.
Or maybe you should speak directly with me,
Chino said.
As you said, the commander speaks for his crew.
For 3 seconds, Gendling continues to stare. Then he turns back to Chino.
I'll have your career, Commander,
he said.
I'd take your ship, too, but it's clear that some upstart half your age will do that.
If the upstart is deserving, more power to him,
Chino said.
Gendling smiles with malice and pride.
This isn't over, Commander. You can be very sure of that. I'll see you at your court-martial. Dismissed!
Commander Chino is silent while returning to the shuttle. Only once aboard and in flight does he speak.
Well,
he said.
His voice holds weariness.
It looks as if I may not be ending my career quite as quietly as I expected.
There is no need to protect me, Thrawn said. The Thunder Wasp's log will answer all his suspicions.
Perhaps,
Chino said.
Logs can be altered, you know.
I did not know that.
Not easily, of course,
Chino said.
He offers a small smile.
Certainly not legally. Doesn't matter. As he said, you have a reputation. More to the point, he can't really bring up all the details of this supposed breach of protocol without exposing his own ineptitude. No, he'll satisfy himself with destroying my career and leave you and the rest of the Thunder Wasp's crew alone.
That is not right or proper.
No, but it is reality,
Chino said.
As I said, my career isn't important. What's important is the future of the Imperial Navy.
He gestures with respect and admiration.
You're that future, Thrawn. It's been a privilege to be your commander.
Thank you, sir, Thrawn said. I've learned a great deal serving under you.
I doubt that,
Chino said.
His tone holds dry humor, with no bitterness or resentment.
But I thank you, and I too have learned a great deal.
Eli had half expected the shuttle to return empty, with both of its passengers consigned to the foremost's brig. To his relief, both Chino and Thrawn emerged from the docking bay. Chino murmured something to Thrawn, and then headed toward the bridge. Thrawn watched until the commander's turbolift car departed, then beckoned Eli to join him.
Ensign, he greeted Eli quietly. I presume you wish to know how our meeting with Admiral Gendling went.
In grief, Not very well.
I'm not surprised, Eli said, wincing. The look on Chino's face as he left the docking bay. I take it the commander took the brunt of it?
Yes, Thrawn said. Partly because he was in command during the battle. Partly because he attempted to shield my role in the outcome.
So because Genlink screwed up, he's taking it out on you,
Eli growled.
I thought only politicians were that level of stupid and nasty.
I've found those characteristics in all fields of endeavor, Thrawn said. Has your research uncovered anything of use?
Maybe.
Eli handed Thrawn his data pad.
The building the transmitter was operating from is owned by a group of humans. The locals don't know their names and can't give anything useful in the way of descriptions. But it's clear you were right about no Umbarans being directly involved in the attack.
I doubt Admiral Gendling will take that into consideration.
No one's taken that into consideration,
Eli said sourly.
Since most of the unrest and turmoil was concentrated in the mining districts, Gendling's already called for the Empire to take direct control of Umbara's entire mining and refining sector.
Interesting,
Thrawn said.
Did you find any indication that Night Swan was directly involved?
The transmitter was run by humans, Eli said. That's as close as we've gotten right now.
Still, we know that Night Swan has been involved in mining and metal smuggling elsewhere, Thrawn said. Tell me, how valuable are the Umbaran mineral deposits?
Very, Banto said. He took his data pad and keyed in a few commands. Several important ones. Key among them, Dunium.
Thrawn pondered a moment. Is there any way to calculate a system's success rate against smugglers?
You can get a rough figure anyway, Eli said. You take the amount of legitimate shipping on some easily identifiable product, those Paklarn grist mollusks, for example, and compare it with the amount being sold elsewhere. The numbers are a little loose, and they obviously don't apply to every product type, but as I said, it gives you a rough figure.
Understood, Thrawn said. Do you have that figure for Umbara? If possible, I would like it for the success rate of smugglers of rare metals or rare metal ores.
Eli called up the relevant numbers, ran a quick mental calculation.
It's very good, he said. Somewhere in the 90% range.
And the number for a comparable Imperial-controlled world?
Eli nodded and busied himself with his data pad.
Looks like... whoa. 65-70%. Though from personal family experience, I'd guess it could actually be as low as 40 or 45.
It would seem we have found the reason for the attack,
Franz said.
The purpose for a clearly futile assault upon an Imperial force. Night Swan wished for the Empire to take control of Umbara's mines.
Because it's easier for him and his smugglers to cheat material past Imperial inspectors than past the Umbarans.
Eli huffed out a breath.
I'll grant that it sounds like Night Swan's brand of deviousness, but we don't even know for sure that he was involved.
He was,
Thrawn said.
He is. Who else would invite me here to demonstrate his handiwork?
Eli blinked.
He what?
Surely it is clear, Thrawn said. He set up his mollusk smuggling group in an area he knew the Thunder Wasp was patrolling.
He made certain the Umbara was mentioned within the smuggler's hearing. He knew of my interest in Clone War weaponry, and made certain the name Night Swan was on at least one order.
Interesting,
Eli murmured. On the surface, for Thrawn to even suggest such a thing bordered on the egomaniacal. Still, the Chiss was seldom wrong about tactical matters. And Night Swan wasn't exactly an ordinary mastermind, either. It was entirely possible that he would do such a thing simply for the challenge of it all.
Well, if it is him, he lost this one.
Not at all,
Thrawn said, his voice grim.
I defeated his vulture droid attack, but winning that encounter was not his true goal.
The Imperial takeover?
Or perhaps the Imperial takeover itself was merely a step, Thrawn said. It may have been his final goal if he was merely a smuggler. But he is more.
So if he's not a smuggler, what is he?
I do not yet know, Thrawn said. Possibly his activities are building to a political confrontation or resolution on some planet or system. Possibly he seeks vengeance or humiliation against some person or organization. But whatever his goals and motivations, he is a person of extreme interest.
I guess we'd better keep an eye out for him then,
Eli said.
Sooner or later, he has to surface.
Incorrect, Ensign. Sooner or later, he will choose to surface.
Chapter 14.
One is born with a unique set of talents and abilities. One must choose which of those talents to nurture, which to set aside for a time, which to ignore completely. Sometimes the choice is obvious. Other times, the hints and proddings are more obscure. Then one may need to undergo several regimens of training and sample several different professions before determining where one's strongest talents lie. This is the driving force behind many life path alterations. There are few sets of skills that match only one specific job. More often they are adaptable to many different professions. Sometimes one can plan such a change. Other times the change appears without warning. In both instances, one must be alert and carefully consider all options. Not every change is a step forward.
It had been a hard day, full of desperate and petty people with desperate and petty problems. By all rights, Arinda should be exhausted. At the same time, it had been a resoundingly successful day, with solutions for nearly all those problems and gushings of heartfelt gratitude. By all rights, she should be ecstatic. She was trying to decide which feeling would dominate her evening and anticipating the start of that evening when there was a warning beep from the outer door. She glanced at the chrono, suppressing a sigh. Technically, the office still had 2 minutes to go. Realistically, none of today's problems had been solved in less than 20. Her evening was evidently going to start later than she'd hoped. But this was her job, and she was good at it. And there wasn't anything better for 10 kilometers in any direction, including up or down. So, however long this took...
Hey, stranger,
Juahira said cheerfully as she walked through the inner door.
How are you doing?
Juahira.
Arinda all but gasped, feeling her face light up in a smile.
I'm fine. What are you doing in the pricey end of the planet?
Oh, this is the pricey end, is it?
Driller asked, walking in behind her.
Hey, at least you make enough to actually live here.
Just barely,
Arinda said, feeling her smile grow a little brighter. Driller had dropped in on the office a couple of times before his uncle came back to reclaim his apartment, but she hadn't seen him since. As for Juahira, she'd come by only once, and that had been nearly 6 months ago. They'd talked a few times on the comm, though, and Juahira had a standing invitation to tour the Federal District if she ever found the time to come to this side of the planet. Apparently, she just had.
It's great to see both of you,
Arinda said, coming around her desk and giving each of them a quick hug.
How long are you going to be here? Do you have plans for the evening? I'm off duty in about a minute and a half.
You sure they can do without you?
Driller asked, looking pointedly at the line of empty desks.
Or did the supervisor decide you were so good they didn't need anyone else?
No,
We're still a fully staffed and thoroughly overworked office,
Arinda said.
Everyone else just happened to have evening plans, and I volunteered to do the last half hour alone.
Well, that's not fair, Juhir said with mock outrage. Serve them right if someone came in here and swept you off your feet.
It's not so bad, Arinda said. Actually, I do my best work when I'm alone.
You like the extra pressure? Driller asked.
I like the lack of witnesses.
He gave her a sideways look.
You're kidding, right?
Arinda shrugged.
You'd be amazed how far a little insinuation will get you with an apartment owner.
What kind of insinuation?
Juhir asked.
Hints that you know what she did last night, Arinda said. Or last month, or last year. Throw out a few vague comments, and most people will fill in the rest. Once they do, they're a lot more open to settling the problem the tenant is having.
Assuming they have some hidden dirt to fill in,
Juhir pointed out.
Everyone has hidden dirt,
Arinda said.
You never said how long you would be here.
You never answered my comment about someone sweeping you off your feet,
Juhir countered.
I thought you were joking,
Arinda said, aware of the permanent hollow spot in the core of her being. She'd met many men over the past year, some of whom had tried to befriend or romance her. She'd tried with a few of them, really, really tried, but nothing had worked out. Nor had she met anyone, man or woman, whom she could call a friend. In her line of work, everyone she encountered started by thinking of her as a helper, champion, or even mother figure. None of those was a good basis for a balanced emotional connection.
I never joke about food,
Juhir said solemnly.
We're hungry, and we bet you are too. So shut this place down and let's go.
I'm with you,
Arinda said, starting her computer's lockdown procedure.
Fair warning. I can't afford to take you anywhere near as fancy as the Alessandre Hotel this time around.
Don't worry. We've got it covered,
Juhir said with an impish smile.
We already have reservations.
At the Alessandre? Seriously?
No, no, no.
Juhir pointed upward.
At the Pinnacle.
Arinda felt her eyes widen.
The Pinnacle? You're joking.
Nope,
Juhir said, grinning even more broadly.
You game?
Sure.
Arinda looked down at her clothing.
In that case, I need to change.
No problem,
Juhir said.
We budgeted time for that.
The Pinnacle wasn't the highest point on Coruscant, but it was the highest point in the Federal District, and it provided magnificent views of the palace, the Senate building, and the various ministries and monuments clustered around them. The clientele matched the view. Every third table, it seemed, sported a face Arinda remembered from her days working for Senator Ranking. It was exhilarating, but at the same time it was vaguely depressing. She'd come to Coruscant to gain connections and influence, and to work her way up the political ladder. Instead, she'd ended up stuck, barely a few rungs from the bottom. And as she gazed across the room, and up the ladder looming mockingly over her, her one-time goal of regaining Price Mining faded ever more into the mists of never. But the food was good enough to almost drive away the wistful pangs of resentment at how she'd been treated. Once or twice along the way, she wondered how Juhir and Driller were paying for all this. But what with the excitement, the memories, and the sheer taste sensations, she didn't wonder very much or very hard.
So, how does it feel being back in the Skylands of Power?
Juhir asked as the waiter delivered their dessert plates.
Very nice,
Arinda said.
I thought I'd put all this behind me, but there really is a lure to it all.
So if you could come back to this life, you would?
Arinda gave a little snort.
What? Is Senator Ranking hiring?
Probably not.
Juihir nodded sideways to Driller.
But Driller is.
Arinda frowned at him.
Really? For what?
For a position with my advocacy group, he said. You do remember that's what I do, right?
Of course,
Arinda said.
I just assumed that people like you were on a hookstring budget. You're really hiring?
We really are, he said, nodding.
And you didn't snatch it up?
Arinda asked, looking at Juihir.
Whatever it is has to be 100 steps up from waitressing at Topples.
I'm not waitressing anymore,
Juihir said, frowning.
You know that.
I dusted off my old martial arts stuff and got into bodyguard training, remember?
Since when?
Arinda asked, frowning right back. Juihir had sometimes talked about her school-age hand-to-hand combat work, but she'd never even hinted she might want to do that sort of thing professionally.
Since about 4 months after you moved here from Bash 4,
Juihir said.
I started part-time with a little dojo 400 levels down from my apartment, and when a full-time position opened up...
Look, I told you all this.
You most certainly did not,
Arinda said.
But...
Juihir looked entreatingly at Driller.
Hey, don't look at me, he said quickly. You told me you told her.
I'm so sorry, Arinda,
Juihir said, wincing.
I would have sworn... Anyway, I've moved over here and have a job at the Yin Cham Dojo now. We do civilian training, but we're also licensed to train government bodyguards. We've got a handful of guards from the Senate with some good word of mouth bringing in new ones.
They're 130 levels down from your office, but thinking of looking for someplace higher,
Driller added.
Pluses and minuses,
Juihir said.
The lower levels are more discreet for aides and assistants whose senators want them to double as bodyguards, but don't want the whole world to know they've been training. The higher levels are more prestigious and might draw more people who are supposed to look like guards.
And are more expensive, Driller murmured.
A lot more expensive,
Juihir agreed, crinkling her nose.
Anyway, to get back to your original question, that's one reason Driller didn't offer me the job.
Arinda had almost forgotten that was where this conversation had started.
And the other reason?
We're looking for an expert in mines, mining and refining, Driller said. Juihir doesn't know the first thing about that stuff, while you know the first thing, the last thing, and all the things in between.
I wouldn't go that far,
Arinda said modestly, her mind racing. Working for an advocacy group wasn't a huge step up, status-wise, but it would once again take her into the centers of political power. That alone made it worth pursuing. Not to mention it would get her away from desperate citizens and their desperate problems.
The downside of the job is that it doesn't come with an apartment like your assistant's office job does,
Driller continued.
But Joey here's got a decent-sized place. It's closer to the Senate building, and she's already told me she'd love a roommate.
Absolutely,
Joey here confirmed.
You have no idea how many times I've collapsed onto the couch, every muscle aching, and wished there was someone there to make dinner without me having to move.
I'm pretty good with dinner,
Arinda said with a shrug. In politics, she'd learned it never paid to look too eager.
And I'm definitely ready to move on to something else. Where and when do I apply for the job?
You just did, Driller said with a grin. Seriously, I've already floated your name, and the rest of the group has already vetted you. If you want the job, it's yours.
Arinda took a deep breath. The hell with not looking too eager.
I want the job.
Great!
Driller picked up his dessert, frowning a little at Juihir.
So, is it proper etiquette to toast a momentous event with a dessert plate?
I don't know,
Juihir said, picking up her own plate.
Let's find out.
And just like that, Orinda was back. It was like waking up from a bad dream. Suddenly, she was among the elite again, walking the ornate hallways of the Senate and office buildings, speaking to the people who ruled the empire. Not just speaking either, but actually being listened to. Back when she'd been delivering data card packets for Senator Ranking, most of the recipients had barely noticed her. But licensed advocacy groups had prestige, if not any actual power, and they were noticed. Now suddenly, it seemed like everyone knew her face and her advocacy group. Some of them even remembered her name. Orinda had survived the lower levels of the federal district, but up here, where the sun shone and the brightest lights glittered, was where she wanted to be. She was back, and she would never leave it. Ever. Whatever it took to stay in the sky lanes of power, she would do it.
Okay, Triller said, sitting Orinda down in front of the Higher Skies Advocacy Group's main computer. Last job of the day, I promise.
You promised that 2 jobs ago,
she reminded him.
Who, me?
He said, looking innocent.
I know. What can I say? You're the mining expert. That means you get all the mining expert jobs.
Right, Orinda agreed. It wasn't like anyone else could do it, after all. Mainly because there never seemed to be anyone else around. At first, she puzzled about that. Driller had explained that most of the time the other members were out of the office, talking to senators or aides, visiting the various ministries, or traveling off-planet to talk with governors or moffs, or just gather first-hand information. He'd also reminded Orinda that she herself was often out of the office, and suggested that it was simple bad luck that she'd missed crossing paths with any of the others. It was a lie, of course. Orinda had figured that out very early on. Either the rest of the staff was off doing nefarious things, or else there was no other staff. But she didn't care. Driller paid on time, and he had enough spare credits to keep her in outfits suitable for the rarefied company she kept these days. More important, his license continued to give her access to the Empire's powerful. Ultimately, that was all that mattered.
So, here's what we need,
Driller said, reaching over her shoulder and tapping a few keys.
There seems to have been an unusual number of Imperial takeovers lately, mining facilities and sometimes whole planets. I want you to pull up the list and evaluate it for the importance of the mines in question, the circumstances of the Imperial takeover, and anything else that might establish a pattern as to what's going on.
What?
What do you mean, what?
Orinda asked.
Your face went all puckered just then,
Driller said.
Is there a problem?
No,
Orinda said. She hadn't realized she'd reacted.
Sorry, I was just thinking about the Empire taking over our family's mine 3 years ago.
Oh, sorry. I'd forgotten about that.
Driller apologized.
If it's too uncomfortable for you to do this...
No, I'm fine,
Orinda assured him.
Okay,
he said.
And don't feel like you have to finish tonight. I've got a late appointment. You okay with closing up alone?
Sure,
Orinda said. The apartment she shared with Jua here was 200 levels down, and not in the best part of the district. But the rowdies usually didn't come out into the walkways and platforms until the sunlight had faded from the bits of clear sky above. At this time of year, that was a good 2 hours away.
Enjoy.
Right, he said dryly. A meeting with a Senate doorkeeper? It's going to be so much fun.
He headed out, locking the door behind him, and Orinda settled in to read. She had assumed Driller was imagining things, seeing patterns and conspiracies that turned out to be figments of his overblown imagination. He had a tendency to do that.
But in this case, he was right on the mark.
There were 20